I winked at Rell, and we carried the jar to the main workbench. Concealing it with our bodies, we lifted it out of the cradle and stood it in the center of the bench. And then I turned back to the three bent heads across the room. Eldridge, would you mind having a look at this one?
One moment.
Eldridge went on poring over an unrolled scroll with his magnifying glass. And Rell and I waited patiently until at last he laid the glass aside and looked up. Like I had, he reacted immediately. I saw the glitter of his spectacles. The rosy glow suffused his bald pate like sunset on the dome of the Taj Mahal. He came quickly to the bench.
Where did you find it? And how many are there? It's sealed.
His hand was actually trembling as he touched the clay tablet. His tone alerted the girls, and they almost ran to join us. We stood about the jar in a reverent circle.
Open it.
Sally broke the short silence. It's almost dinner time. I glanced at my watch. We'd better leave it until tomorrow, I suggested mildly. And both girls turned on me furiously.
We can't, Sally began.
And then she saw my expression, and relief flooded her face.
You shouldn't joke about things like that, she told me sternly.
Well, Professor Hamilton, what are we waiting for? I asked.
Yes, what indeed?
He demanded. And the two of us went to work on the seal. We used a pair of side cutters to nip the gold wire, and then carefully worked the seal loose. The lid lifted easily, and there was the usual linen-wrapped cylinder. However, there was not a suggestion of the unpleasant leathery odour. Eldridge, whose arms are like a pair of thin white candles, was unable to lift the jar. I tilted it carefully onto its side, and while he steadied it, I withdrew the weighty roll. The wrapping was well preserved and folded off in one piece. Nobody spoke as we stared at the exposed cylinder. I had guessed what it would contain. There is only one material which is that heavy. But it was still a delicious thrill to have my expectations realized. It was another writing scroll, but it was not of leather. This scroll was a continuous sheet of pure gold. It was 1/16 of an inch thick, 18 inches wide, and a fraction over 28 feet long. It weighed 1,954 ounces, fine ounces, with an intrinsic value of over $85,000. There were five of them. $425,000. But this was a fraction of the value of the contents. The beautifully mellow metal rolled readily as though eager to impart its ancient secrets to us. The characters had been cut with a craftsman's skill into the metal with a sharp engraver's tool, but the reflected light from its surface dazzled the reader. We all watched with complete fascination as Eldridge spread lamp black across the blinding surface and then carefully wiped off the excess. Each character stood out now, etched in black against the golden background. He adjusted his spectacles and pored deliberately over the cramped lines of Punic. He started making non-committal grunts and murmurs while we crowded closer, like children at story time. I think I spoke for all of us when at last I blurted out, "Oh, for God's sake, read the bloody thing!" Eldridge looked up and grinned wickedly at me. "This is very interesting." He kept us all in aching suspense for a few seconds longer while he lit a cigarette, and then he began to read. It was immediately clear that we'd chosen the first scroll in a series and that Eldridge was reading the author's note. "Go thou unto my store, and take from thence 500 fingers of the finest gold of Opit. Fashion therefrom a scroll that will not corrupt, that these songs may live forever, that the glory of our nation may live forever in the words of our beloved Hui, son of Ammon, high priest of Baal, and favorite of Astarte, bearer of the cup of life, and axeman of all the gods. Let men read his words and rejoice as I have rejoiced. Let men hear his songs and weep as I have wept. Let his laughter echo down all the years, and his wisdom live forever." Thus spoke Lannon Hyrcanus, 47th Grey Lion of Opit, king of Punt and the Four Kingdoms, ruler of the southern seas, and keeper of the waterways, lord of the plains of grass and the mountains beyond. Eldridge stopped reading and looked about the circle of our intent faces. We were all silent. This was something far removed from the dry accounts, the list of trade, and the council orders. This scroll was imbued with the very breath, the essence of a people and a land. "Wow!" Ral whispered. "They had a pretty good press agent." And I felt irritation scratch across my nerves at this irreverence. "Go on," I said. And Eldridge nodded. He crushed out the stub of his cigarette in the ashtray at his elbow and began to read again, pausing only to unroll and lampblack each new turn of the scroll. He read on steadily while we listened, completely entranced. The hours fled on nimble feet as we heard the poems of Hui Ben Ammon sung again after 2,000 years. Opit had produced her first philosopher and historian. As I listened to the words of this long-dead poet, I felt a curious kinship of the spirit with him. I understood his pride and petty conceits. I admired his bold vision, forgave his wilder flights of fancy and his more obvious exaggerations, and was held captive by the story web he wove about me. His story began with Carthage, surrounded by the wolves of Rome, besieged and bleeding, as the legions of Scipio Aemilianus pressed forward on her walls to the chant of "Carthage must die." He told us how Hasdrubal sent a swift ship flying along the shore of the Mediterranean to where Hamilcar, the last scion of the Barkers, a family long since fallen from power and politics, lay with a war fleet of 57 great ships off Hippo on the North African coast. How the besieged leader called for succor, and of the storm and adverse winds that denied it to him. Scipio broke through into the city, and Hasdrubal died with a reeking sword in his hand, hacked into pieces by the Roman legionaries, below the great altar in the temple of Ashmun upon the hill. As Eldridge paused, I spoke for the first time in half an hour. "That gives us our first date, the Third Punic War and the final destruction of Carthage, 146 BC. I think you'll find that is also about the date point for the Opet calendar," Eldridge agreed. "Oh, go on," said Sally. "Please go on." Two biremes escaped the carnage and the sack and rape of Carthage. They fled with the great winds to where Hamilcar lay, fretting and storm-bound at Hippo, and they told him how Hasdrubal had died and how Scipio had dedicated the city to the infernal gods, had burnt it, thrown down its walls, how he'd sold the 50,000 survivors into slavery, and had sowed the fields with salt,
and forbidden under pain of death any man to live amongst the ruins. So great a hatred, so cruel a deed, could only spring from the heart of a Roman, cried the poet. And Barker Hamilcar mourned Carthage for 20 days and 20 nights before he sent for his sea captains. They came to him, all 9 of them, and Hui, the poet, named them Zadal, Hannes, Philo, Habakkuk Lal, and the others. Some would fight, but most would fly. For how could this pitiful remnant of Carthaginian power stand against the legions of Rome and her terrible fleet of galleys? There seemed to be no sanctuary for a Carthaginian. Rome ground all the world beneath her armored heels. And then Habakkuk Lal, the old sea lion and master navigator, reminded them of the voyage that Hanno had made 300 years before, beyond the gates of Hercules, to a land where the seasons were inverted. Gold grew like flowers upon the rocks, and elephants lived in great herds upon the plains. They'd all of them read the account that Hanno had written of his voyage inscribed on tablets in the great temple of Baal Hamon at Carthage, now destroyed by Rome. They recalled how he spoke of a river and a mighty lake, where a gentle yellow people had welcomed him and traded gold and ivory for beads and cloth, and how he had lingered there to repair his ships and plant a harvest of corn. It is a good land, he had written, and rich. Thus, in the first year of the Exodus, Barker Hamilcar had led a fleet of 59 great ships, each with 150 oarsmen and officers aboard, westward beneath the towering gates of Hercules, and then southward into an unknown sea. With him went 9,000 men, women, and children. The voyage lasted 2 years, as they made slow progress down the western coast of Africa. There were 1,000 hardships and dangers to meet and overcome. Savage tribes of black men, animals, and disease when they landed, and shoals and currents, winds and calms upon the sea. 2 years after setting out, they sailed into the mouth of a wide, placid river, and journeyed up it for 16 days, dragging their ships bodily through the shallows, until finally they reached the mighty lake of which Hanno had written. They landed upon the furthest shore under a tall red cliff of stone, and Barker Hamilcar died of the shaking fever which he'd carried with him from the pestilential lands of the north. His infant son, Lannan Hamilcar, was chosen as the new king, and the 9 admirals were his counselors. They named their new land Opet, after the legendary land of gold, and they began to build their first city at a place where a deep pool of water sprang from the cliffs. The pool and the city were dedicated to the goddess Astarte.
My God, it's 4 o'clock.
Ral Davidson broke the spell, which had held us all for most of the night, and I realized how tired I was, emotionally and physically exhausted, but well content. I had found my Pliny. Now I could go to London in triumph. I had it all. How swiftly the days passed now. I was at work each morning before sunrise. My typewriter clattered steadily, and the filled sheets piled up beside it. I worked until noon each day, and spent the afternoons and evenings in the repository, listening to the songs from the golden books of the poet Hui. There was no question that the translation could be completed before April the 1st. Indeed, we'd be lucky to have the 2 first scrolls out of the 5 completed by then. There was equally no possibility that we could postpone the symposium that had been approved by the Council of the Royal Geographical Society for that date. The Public Relations Office of the London branch of Anglo-Stuyvesant had completed the arrangements, invitations had been issued and accepted, accommodation, transport,
and 100 other details had been arranged and confirmed. It was in a race to marshal and present as much of this incredible plethora of facts and legend as I could in the time left to me. Always I must guard against the temptation to romanticize my subject. The words of Hui were inflammatory to my emotions. I wanted to copy his ebullient style, to laud his heroes and castigate the villains as he did. All of us at the City of the Moon were becoming deeply involved in the story. Even Eldridge Hamilton, who was the only one of us not of Africa, was caught up in the grandeur of it. While to the rest of us, for whom Africa was academically and emotionally the well of our existence, these songs were a compulsive, living cavalcade. How often I found our recent history but an echo of the endeavours and adventures of these men of Opet. How closely they seemed linked to us, despite the passage of nearly 2,000 years. For the first 5 years, the settlement on the shores of the lake prospered. The buildings were of log and mud. The men of Opet came to terms with their new land. They fell into a trading relationship with the Yui. These were the yellow people that Hanno had described 300 years before, tall, graceful men with slanted eyes and delicate features. Clearly, they were the ancestors of the Hottentots. They were a pastoral people with herds of goats and small scrub cattle. They were also hunters and trappers, and gatherers of the flakes of alluvial gold from the gravel beds of the rivers. In the name of the infant king, Habakkuk Lel concluded a treaty with Yui, king of the Yui, a treaty that granted all the land between the great rivers and the hills of Tuya to the men of Opet, in return for 5 bolts of linen and 20 swords of iron. Well satisfied, Habakkuk Lel, to whom the set and send of the sea were as the coursing of blood through his own veins, returned with 5 of his swiftest ships laden with the gold and ivory of Opet to the Middle Sea. He completed the return journey in 9 months, setting up staging posts along the western shores of Africa, and returned with a cargo of beads and linen and the luxuries of civilization. He had pioneered the trade route along which the treasures of southern Africa would pour to the known world. But ever wary of Rome's vengeful eye, he covered his tracks like the crafty old sea fox he was. He brought with him, also, new recruits for the colony at Opet, metallurgists, masons, shipbuilders, and gentlemen adventurers. However, the trickle of Yui gold and ivory shriveled as the accumulated stores of ages were exhausted. Habakkuk Lel led a company of 100 men to the city of Yui. He sought the right to prospect and hunt throughout the kingdom of the Yui, and the king agreed readily, placing his mark at the foot of a leather scroll covered with characters he didn't understand. Then he called a feast to entertain his honored guests. The beer was brought in great gourds, the oxen roasted whole over the pits of glowing coals, and the lithe Yui maids danced naked, their yellow bodies glistening with oil in the sunlight.